My name is Jackie Hughes, and my background is as an investigative journalist, a filmmaker, and for the past 10 years I was a commissioning editor at the BBC. I was responsible, amongst other things, for commissioning series such as The Monastery, The Convent, The Retreat, and The Big Silence. And for those of you who know Father Christopher, that's where my introduction to this world and this evening began. Our relationship goes back 6 or 7 years when I was first commissioning religion at the BBC and began to think about how I could tell different type of religious stories on television and tell them in a different way. And one thing led to another, and I met Father Christopher, and he was brave enough to join that conversation about how we might tell those stories in a different way. And here we are, I think 5, 6, 7 years later, still having that conversation. Now, I did ponder starting my introduction in a slightly different way, because I could have very truthfully and equally truthfully have said, my name is Jackie Hughes, and actually I'm a dinosaur, albeit a dinosaur that's escaped extinction so far. Because when I started working in the media, I was working as a print journalist, and it was working with Hot Metal Press. And every letter of every word that I wrote, that we wrote, would be crafted from molten lead and set on a form downstairs and on the print floor by an army of skilled craftsmen. And we journalists would be invited down to the print floor to sub-edit our work, and we would stand either side of the stone, as it was called, and we would read our words in mirror image, and we would tell the craftsmen which letters to correct and so on. And there was a total separation between the crafts of the print floor and the crafts of the editorial floor, so much so and so harshly enforced that if we soft-handed journalists were to so much as touch the stone, we could very much risk a downing of tools and a walkout. When I moved into radio, it was with reel-to-reel recorders, and I would sit with my scalpel blade and my reels of tape, slicing and dicing my words together into something that was hopefully broadcastable. When I moved into television, I began working in current affairs, and we still shot on film. And every 10-minute long reel would be very carefully considered before it was shot. You know, this was valuable material, and every single program required a team of skilled camera operators, assistants, sound recordists, sparks, and later in the cutting room, editors and assistant editors working their magic on these miles and miles of celluloid with their white gloves and their Steenbeck machines. And that seems a million years ago, but actually that's all within the last 20 years. And spin on 20 years, and along with everyone else, I find myself in the digital age, an age in which we can witness, record, edit, upload our content in real time. We can broadcast it to the world. We can blog about it. We can update it. We can respond to feedback about it in an instant, anytime, anywhere, and to anyone. So the tools of my trade have changed out of all recognition, but what of the trade itself? Because the two are not to be confused. But it is my belief that the changes represented by the dawn of the digital age and the arrival of social media in particular are of an altogether different sort than the changes I've just described about my own career. Because it's not just the technology of communication that's changed. Communication itself has changed. There has been a communications revolution, and it is a genuinely global phenomenon. We've moved from a world in which we, trained journalists and filmmakers and broadcasters, were the magicians. We were the wizards, the keepers of the great secrets of the media. We decided which stories to tell, and we decided how to tell them, and critically, when to tell them. Because only we had the knowledge and the access to the stories and the means to capture them and communicate them. We owned the news, we owned the stories, we owned the conversation. Now, anyone with something as simple as a mobile phone can broadcast anything to the world 24/7, and the idea of anyone owning the story is history. This definitely represents a huge challenge to all of us, and it's one that journalists and programme makers and those in traditional and mainstream media wrestle with all the time. What becomes of what we do in this world? If we live in a world of user-generated postings and tweets and blogging and uploading of images and personal witness, first-hand witness accounts of events and unfiltered data and noise and gossip, what becomes of proper journalism? What becomes of the inquiry, the testing of ideas and statements, the weighing up of all sides, and the striving to record accurately and impartially a complete picture as possible? What value does that have anymore, and what value do we have? And I've heard, and I'm sure you've read, many people say, well, it's had its day. The trade of journalism is dead. The story is owned by the people, not the journalists. We're all content creators now. I have to say, I'm much more optimistic than that. You could say that I would be, given that it's my trade. But I honestly believe that in a world of ambient noise, people look for distinct voices. When they're bombarded with as-it's-happening imagery and stories, people crave context and clarity and expertise. They seek out the cool, considered, more objective, rational backstory. They want to know how it all fits together and what it all means. And for that, they will look to trusted sources, trusted voices, and trusted channels of information. That's the good news. But I also believe that there's no room for complacency here, and there's no comfort to be found in the belief, well, that's okay then, because that's who we are. We are those trusted storytellers. We're those people. We're fine. Because I genuinely think that it's no longer viable or valid to stick to the old top-down business model of delivery of communication, the one-way traffic, the we have something good to tell you or something to share with you. I think it's obsolete. I think the conversations are going on anyway all around us, and our role is to join the conversation, to verify, to debunk, to contextualise, in other words, to add value. And we can only do that by truly engaging. The very existence of social media shifts every one of our interactions with audiences from the inactive to the active, from inaction to action, in a state of permanent momentum. Communication is now always. It's back and forth, all the time, in all of the places and all of the platforms that we want to engage with and where the people that we want to engage with happen to be. They're in the driving seat now. They are as in control of the narrative as you are, and that's the shift. That's the challenge. But the prize, if we grasp it, is a virtuous circle of communication, interaction, and ultimately engagement. I'll come back to that theme shortly because I believe it's a theme that holds good not just for us journalists and those of us in the media, but it certainly holds good for every single one of us who's in the business of having something to say, a message to impart, a story, an idea, a belief, or a vision to share. According to Google CEO Eric Schmidt, by the end of today, the web will have filled up with more information than existed in its entirety prior to 2003. I mean, it is a raging torrent of postings and tweets and retweets and photos and status updates and audio clips and video and so on. Because the digital space is, after all, by definition, infinite. And the rapid growth in digital access, thanks largely to mobile devices and wireless broadband, means that there are now literally billions of digitally active people on the planet. And it's a trend that just continues to grow. Indeed, access to digital media is now considered so important that it's included in the country's standard of living survey. And the last government and this remain committed to rolling out digital literacy campaigns and supporting people's access to and knowledge of digital media. There was a really interesting research report released earlier this year called This Digital Life, which pulled together some fascinating statistics on global digital trends. Not just the numbers, but the behaviours and the attitudes that go with some of those trends. And they concluded that there were six distinct types of digital behaviour or digital groupings, which I won't go into here, but I will share a couple of the highlights from that survey with you. So that survey found that globally, 61% of online users are using the internet daily, compared to 54% using television, 36% radio, and 32% for newspapers. And in rapid growth markets, engagement with digital activity has overtaken that of mature markets. So in places like Egypt and China, people rapidly and enthusiastically become fully digitally active. In China, 4 out of 5 people with digital access are blogging, and over half of those in Brazil write their own blog or forum entry, compared to less than a third in the US. The internet has also become the default option for photo sharing amongst online users, especially in rapid growth markets, especially Asia. 38% of book sales are now through Amazon, a company which also reported that its e-books had outsold hardbacks published in print this year. As I said earlier, by far the biggest driver of growth in the digital world is social media and social networking. And the transition from PC to mobile is driving a change in behaviour. So mobile users are spending more than 3 hours a week on social networking sites compared to those still using their PCs, and it drops to below 2 hours. But in emerging markets, those figures almost double. People in the Middle East and China, Malaysia, Russia and Turkey are spending up to 9 hours a week on mobile digital platforms, on social sites and social networking sites. It's very easy to talk about social media, and it's a term that we all kind of bandy about without probably knowing what we mean by it or what it means. And I was struggling to write a definition of it and realised that no definition can actually touch on the behaviours that go with social media. You know, a technical definition would go something like the various activities that integrate technology, social interaction, and the construction of words, pictures, video, and audio. But as I said, it cannot touch on the behaviours that go with the consumption and the use of that media. People in the business talk about there being a social layer that now sits on top of people's lives. We all now conduct a huge part of our lives in that social space. We carry out the considerable, if not the majority, of our communicating, our sharing, posting, accessing, forwarding, blogging, buying, liking, advocating, influencing, reading, listening, and viewing in digital space. And we expect to do it seamlessly on all platforms. At this point, I was going to show a small clip from YouTube, which Alexandra and I discussed, but the ability to set up a screen here slightly defeated us. So I'm going to include the link in the print version of this, because it does in 20 seconds more than I can do in words here, and it's quite an interesting clip. But in essence, here are some of the highlights. So the number of years it's taken to reach 50 million users. Radio, 38 years. Television, 13 years. The internet, 4 years. Facebook added 200 million users in 9 months. And if Facebook were a country, it would be the third largest in the world. There are 60 million status updates on Facebook daily. More than 200 million people blog, and more than half are posting fresh content daily. That's quite phenomenal figures. And from a marketing point of view, and this is really interesting for anyone who has a brand or a company or anything that they want to get noticed, is 25% of search results for the 20 largest brands are linked to user-generated content. In other words, people recommending or liking or sharing their thoughts and their recommendations for products is the main driver to those sites. And we already know that consumers trust peer recommendations over anything else. So the figures are quite astonishing, but what they can't quite capture is the power of the social space for transformation and for change. Social space is where all the conversations are happening. It is where all the influencing and all the advocacy is going on. It's where tribes and communities and friends and followers and influencers can spring up in an instant. And it's where ideas and stories can go viral in minutes and change perceptions and knowledge in an instant. You only have to look at the role that social media has played in recent news events, from natural disasters to the Arab Spring, to understand its power. You know, it was no coincidence that kind of controversial Islam-baiting American preacher Terry Jones chose to film his Quran-burning stunt and post it on YouTube, subtitled in Arabic. You know, he didn't need a congregation. He didn't need people in following him or, you know, arriving at his church. He just needed a cheap camera and access to the internet. He knew it would go, you know, he knew his stunt would be seen by millions in no time, and so it was. Now, there's a very real academic debate going on about all of this, and it kind of goes along the lines of, does spending so much time in social space on multiple social sites make us all more shallow and unable to concentrate on anything for very long? Is it actually rewiring our brains for less depth? Or is that just the same argument they used with the arrival of mass printing or radio or television? And actually, what the digital age heralds is the democratization of access for all, the chance to take communication and the creation of content out of the hands of the few and deliver it into the hands of the many, a new renaissance. Well, we may never know the answer to that, but what is unquestionable is that there has been a revolution in the way we communicate, and I think it's beholden upon all of us to understand it and the behaviours that go with it. What we know is that connectedness is at the heart of it all. We can tell just from the sheer amount of time that people are spending in social space that they like to feel connected. They want to feel part of a community, part of many communities. And they put real value in those connections with their peers. They put real value in the recommendations of their peers and in sharing ideas and in acting in concert. You know, there's an inherent behavioural contract in place in this world, the idea of forward sharing. It's the term that describes the drive to discover nuggets of information, ideas, text, pictures, stories, anything that's considered of value, and to share it forward. It's a key tenet of the social web. Others have said, sharing is the power pulse. It's the passionate heartbeat that makes social media a transformation, a game changer for everything from commerce to education. Sharing makes people feel good. It's powered by honest communications, fueled by the passion of people to connect with ideas and products and courses, and to share that connection forward. I think this is good news, and I think it's good news for you. I would suggest that Catholicism is a relational religion, and you are who you are because of your relationship with others. And initiating conversations and the call to dialogue is at the heart of the religion. What else stands out in this rather cluttered world? From my point of view, what I see standing out is the power of stories and the power of pictures. People are drawn to stories by instinct. And we program makers are always looking to tell stories, not hand down information. You know, the classic offer at the heart of what we do is that via the micro, we will illustrate the macro. In other words, by telling a personal story, we shed light on a bigger truth. And this, again, I think should hearten you all. It's about the importance of storytelling, and you have some great stories to tell. I think it would be naive to suggest that there weren't lots of undesirable aspects to the social web. I don't think it's a, you know, a fantastic good news story. And I think they include the ease with which gossip can spread unhindered, the way in which sharing, especially if it's sharing something you dislike, can turn into something bordering on mass bullying. I think the oversharing, which shakes up all of our concepts of privacy, is quite worrying. The sheer noise and clutter and trivia and just the unbelievable amount of time that humans can spend online is also of some concern. And the long tail of digital, which means that every single utterance, every error, every flaw, every misjudgment, everything said in haste lives on forever and ever and ever. But what is heartening, I think, is that we can begin to see the way in which these relatively new behaviours are beginning to settle. Social space is amazingly self-policing. Communities that grow up around ideas or interests or shared passions are very protective of the core values of those groups and communities And if they sniff a rat, they're pretty quick to kick it out. On a similar note, one of the things I've noticed is authenticity has real value. People are very quick to spot fake voices, and they gravitate instead to what they regard as credible, genuine ideas and genuine content that are aligned with their values. They expect transparency and honesty, and they demand meaningful dialogue. We see, in my world, the growing attraction of premium quality content, of trusted sources and materials. But generally, we see viable social network sites setting up dedicated purely to altruistic behaviours, to answering other users' questions, or to seeking out and sharing the best news stories. And these are behaviours that play to both of our strengths, I think. Our challenge as storytellers and communicators, and I would dare to suggest it's the same challenge that you all face, is we have to work hard to understand all of this and what it means for what we do. We have great stories to tell, and we have stories that we know would capture the imagination and enrich lives and change perceptions. And we've worked hard at what we do, and our experience and our expertise amounts to something. There's a phrase that I use that I quite like, and I've seen used a lot all the time now, and it's social by design. And it means having at the forefront of your strategy for communication is a clear understanding of your social strategy, of how social media works. Because there isn't any hierarchy in the social space. People aren't waiting for official pronouncements. There's no one centre that they're gravitating to. What they are gravitating to is towards content and conversations that they value or which come recommended to them. So how will people find what you have to say? On which platforms and how? Who will be your storytellers, your advocates, your influencers, your messengers? I would say that probably every single person in the room should be a storyteller and an advocate and be prepared to engage, fully engage, all the time. A lot of the kind of lead work on understanding this world has come, as I'm sure you can understand, from marketing companies who have a very real need to understand how, in a changing media landscape, they can drive people to their brands and to their products. And a lot of our understanding of which types of social media work in which way come from those worlds. And smart companies really, really, really get it. You know, they realise that they need to do something much more than just unleash their subject matter experts into digital space, but realise that they actually need to activate them in multiple channels at once and equip them in how to create compelling narratives. They call it transmedia storytelling, and I think it's an idea that offers all of us the chance to take ownership of our own story rather than let others own your narrative. As any said, it comes with one rider. Be under no illusion that you can own the conversation once it begins. You can be part of it, and you can actively respond and engage, but you can no longer presume to own the conversation. I think it's very easy for us in traditional mainstream media, and it's probably easier for organisations like the church to be quite dismissive of all of this and think that what we have to say and what we have to offer is above and beyond all of this and exists beyond space and time, and that we shouldn't need to get down into this kind of swirling ocean of social space. But I really don't think we have a choice. And the prize, as I said, is a chance to reach and to genuinely engage with new audiences. When I was doing a bit of background reading for this talk and to come here tonight, I read back through the last 3 years of World Communication Day speeches, including this year's by Pope Benedict. And I was amazed at just how apposite those speeches were. So here's an extract. The new technologies are not only changing the way we communicate, but communication itself. So much so that it could be said that we are living through a period of vast cultural transformation. This means spreading information and knowledge is giving birth to a new way of learning and thinking, with unprecedented opportunities for establishing relationships and building fellowship. Pope Benedict himself said this year, "I would like then to invite Christians confidently and with an informed and responsible creativity to join the network of relationships which the digital era has made possible. This is not simply to satisfy the desire to be present, but because this network is an integral part of human life. The web is contributing to the development of new and more complex intellectual and spiritual horizons, new forms of shared awareness. I couldn't really think of anything better to end on than that, and I don't think any of us would argue with that, I think. Thank you.